This is an NPR special. In countries where freedom of speech and expression are not guaranteed, internet companies like Google and YouTube are finding it difficult to offer their services. In 2008, the Global Network Initiative, or GNI, was created as a response to internet censorship. The GNI is an international nonprofit dedicated to preventing online censorship as well as ensuring individual privacy rights. In a recent lecture at the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin, a panel of guests gathered to examine how the GNI can defend free speech on the internet. Guests include Google's public policy director, Susan Poynter, who's based in London, and Arvid Ganison, director of business and human rights at the Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C. We begin the discussion with Susan Poynter.
Just up front, I declare an interest. I'm a passionate believer in the potential that the internet brings for increasing access to information, for increasing the ability to communicate with each other, to challenge information also, to be part of that information creation process. And I think that brings, you know, all sorts of amazing opportunities for protecting human rights and free expression in particular. But I'm also not naive. At the end of the day, it's a communications platform. It's not some miraculous human rights silver bullet. It doesn't suddenly transport us into this freedom of expression and human rights utopia. But I think it is a platform by which there are a lot of opportunities to reinforce efforts along that path. It's true also that its very openness, the openness that the internet allows, that open exchange of communication, that interaction across linguistic borders, across political borders, across geographical borders. That openness also, let's say, attracts the attention of those that have traditionally preferred communications channels that are less open. And I think that's a reality, and I think we're, you know, beginning to see that in various parts of the world. Particularly, it has to be said, when it comes to user-generated content. I think the internet has opened up opportunities there for all of us to be able to contribute to a discussion at an international level, something that hasn't always been as easy as it now is. And that obviously, again, draws the attention of perhaps of those who have traditionally been able to control the communication and the type of information that flows. And in that sense, I really do believe, and Google believes, that we're sort of at a critical moment right now of... We need to appreciate what the internet has allowed to happen in order to underpin transparency and human rights exposure of human rights abuse. But we need to appreciate what it is in order to know when it's under threat as well. And I think I'll come on to some of the characteristics of that we just need to be alert to, I think. And in that sense, what is it about the internet that makes it a platform for underpinning human rights and transparency and good governance more than perhaps any we've seen to date? And I would say it's the technology. It's the inherent design of the technology. It's inherently global. Internet technology is inherently global. It's inherently open. It's inherently decentralized, with no central gatekeeper, no permission-based access. Any of you can go onto the internet. You don't have to ask someone for a license to use it. You can choose as users how you choose to access it, where you choose to access it, when you choose to access it, how you choose to access it. And I think that's one of the great novelties of the internet. It's that end-to-end connectivity. Any of us can choose to connect with any legitimate content that is made available by any other person to that platform. Again, you know, unprecedented democratization of access to information and the ability to contribute to that information. We've also seen, and I spend, you know, a fair amount of time in places like Africa, and you can see this huge leapfrogging of technology to move to an environment where actually mobile is becoming the preferred way of accessing information as well on the internet. And we've also seen how mobile technology has been used to communicate back to us from places like Iran in the post-election period. Where does Google come into this? Obviously, it's part of our very existence, our raison d'etre, when Larry and Sergey set the company up from their university dormitory room. It was about how do we make this increasing volume of information that is being put online easily accessible, discoverable, findable by people. So it's what led to the company being set up in the first place. Increasingly, we've been offering platforms for communication, so things like YouTube. Many of you will know the video sharing platform YouTube. Google owns YouTube. Also things like Blogger, but also things like Maps. You'd be amazed, and again, if I see it in parts of the world where it's a novelty to have access to a map of your area or of your country. And then the ability to put information on top of those maps in layers is a whole new platform for showing the reality of a country. And that could be public services, things like, you know, where to find your polling station, where to find your post office, your community clinic, but also where are there crises. And we've seen the likes of organizations like USAID using maps as a platform to then show crises, humanitarian efforts around the world. Also translate, and I always call out translation services because I think it's something, again, we've maybe taken for granted as a tool in allowing us to access information on a global level and to contribute to discussions at a global level. The fact that we can now, in our own language, post information to the web, knowing that there are online, easily usable online translation tools that allow someone in another community, another country, to understand that contribution. And we, when we're looking for information, we're no longer limited to our own linguistic resource, if you like. So I always plug translation services, particularly, again, when it comes to understanding the wider world and having a window to what's going on in the wider world. As was mentioned at the beginning, you know, there are protections for human rights. Article 19 of the UN Convention on Human Rights, the freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas. And this is what's interesting, given that this was written back in 1948, through any media and regardless of frontiers. Thankfully, someone at the time had the foresight to think that there might be an internet in future. And I think that's very important when you're looking at freedom of expression on the internet and protecting human rights. Google services, as I mentioned at the beginning, like many others, are in the focus of efforts to restrict information as an organization that offers opportunities to access and exchange information. We're obviously sometimes going to be in the focus of efforts to move in another direction. And it's not always just about the obvious. China was mentioned at the beginning. It's not always just the obvious firewalls and bans and access bans, and I'm sure we'll come into some of these in the discussion. There are also more subtle ways that that openness and freedom on the internet is being challenged, and things we ought to be paying attention to. So things like overreaching content removal requests, even where perhaps the request is something very legitimate, like child pornography. Restrictions on cross-border incoming services. Restrictions on users being able to access services that are based in another country. Licensing requirements. So requirements to meet some sort of local licensing test in order to be able to allow citizens within that country access to those online services and platforms. I think what's even more interesting is that just that it doesn't necessarily have to be something physical like that. It can also be creating a culture within a country that makes it quite clear what you can and can't talk about or write about or blog about publicly. And that self-censorship on contributing to a dialogue online can be as damaging and as long-lasting, perhaps longer-lasting, than any ban, any black and white ban. There are also issues about censorship being used as a trade barrier, but I'll leave that for another discussion given our focus here tonight. Just perhaps another couple of quick comments. One, I don't think, you know, even Google, by the way, is not the internet, and I think it's worth saying that, you know, there's a lot of information out there on the internet. Google offers some tools, some platforms for accessing and sharing that information. We also don't have all the answers of how a company navigates technology being inherently globally accessible and what that means for different poles and cultures and laws around the world. It's something we are navigating on a daily basis and addressing some of those poles and challenges along the way. If I take, for example, YouTube, YouTube is not a free-for-all. There are laws in the world that apply online just as much as offline. YouTube has its own community guidelines in addition that essentially say, as YouTube, we say that these things are unacceptable on our site. We just don't want to see it on the site. So things like, you know, pornography or sexually explicit content, animal abuse, copyright infringement, privacy infringement, predatory behavior, hate speech, etc. So even on that platform where we have a strong bias in favor of freedom of expression, including freedom of political expression, which is where a lot of the sensitivity, in fact, lies. There are still, you know, some limits, if you like, to what is considered acceptable on that particular service. So my concluding opening remarks, I guess, are the internet is this amazing platform. I think one of my biggest concerns, if you like, is that we actually take it for granted, especially in this part of the world. As I say, I do have the privilege of travelling regularly, travelling broadly, and just seeing that tangible excitement still about having access to information, about knowing what your government is doing, about knowing how your tax money is being spent, about knowing where to find post offices and clinics and mapping information. We sort of take all of that for granted, and yet, even in my personal lifetime, I can remember, in fact, I was working in the European Parliament at the time, and suddenly I had a fax machine, and it made my life so much easier. There was no internet at the time, and I think it's just incredible. It's a sign of its success, really, the speed with which we've taken it for granted. But my concern with that is actually in taking it for granted, we actually may not always be paying enough attention to where that platform as an open communication platform is perhaps being chipped away or under threat. And my personal plea is that we should continue to appreciate that. There's an expression, you only miss what you had when it's gone. And I really would hate to see the internet in that position. We have this amazing opportunity for transparency, throwing a spotlight on human rights abuse, on providing more information, on challenging information, on getting different viewpoints. And I think my urge to you all in my opening comments would be, let's stay vigilant to any threats to that open platform so that we can continue to realise the positive benefits of that open platform for human rights and free expression. And I specifically haven't covered GNI because I know my colleague here is about to, but I'm sure we'll come back to that in the discussion. Thank you.
Arvind, you are the co-founder of the GNI. Can you tell us more about it?
One of many. before I take too much credit for also inventing the internet or anything else, I'll be careful there.
You didn't?
Not yesterday, so we'll see. I wanted to open and just talk about the importance of the internet to Human Rights Watch and also talk about the GNI a bit and how it fits in to our overall, Human Rights Watch's overall view on how to protect freedom of expression and privacy online. And I wanted to just emphasize something that both speakers had already mentioned, but wanted to elaborate on a little bit more. And that is that neither Google nor Human Rights Watch today would be here had it not been for the internet. And there are many reasons for that. In the case of Google, it's obvious that Google developed a tool and a product for the internet that is now invaluable to all of us and is a verb, which should tell you how invaluable it is at this point. For Human Rights Watch, it is because it has transformed the way we do human rights work. And I know when I first started at Human Rights Watch, people talked about what happened in 1978 when people would smuggle letters out of the Soviet Union or they would take handwritten materials out of a country to disseminate to the world, usually through print, maybe through radio, and even more rarely through television if they were lucky. The internet changed all that. I mean, today, I can have a meeting in Berlin with my colleagues in New York about a report that was documenting abuses in Ethiopia instantaneously. And we can get that information out on our website, through email, through other electronic communications that were literally non-existent 15 or 20 years ago. And that has dramatically changed how we, as an organization, can exercise global reach, global influence, global monitoring, and global advocacy. And maybe even more importantly, it has changed the way a local group can get specific information out in any country to the rest of the world. And one of the more notable examples is what's happened with YouTube in Egypt, for example. YouTube has become a medium for local activists to videotape and document police abuses, which then go out to the world and ultimately lead the government to change its practices, but not without trying to shut down that site. And that's the point I wanted to make, is that for all the potential the internet has and has exhibited to change and improve human rights, it is precisely because of that that so many governments are investing so heavily in trying to stop the flow of information. And that is why China and Vietnam and Burma and even what we would consider open or democratic countries like India or sometimes even in the Netherlands or France are taking steps that in some cases make sense from one perspective, but in fact are a threat to the openness of the internet. And it's out of that understanding that we started to look at human rights and the internet as a discrete and standalone issue. But I don't actually think we fully realized how much the threat to the internet was as much a threat to Human Rights Watch and human rights work as it is as something, as a threat to freedom of expression to some other person or some other institution. And that really changed for us in 2006 when we documented how Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and other companies were censoring information online in China in order to comply with Chinese government mandates on censorship. And what that really opened our eyes to is two things. One is that the clear potential of the internet is being realized, but it's being controlled by governments that want to censor information. And in a situation like China that has an enormous market, that has a very sophisticated and well-resourced government, even the world's best-known companies can be subject to that pressure without some kind of rules. And at that point, we realized that we probably needed to do several things. One is recognize what the threats to the internet were, and two, work to try and curb those threats. And there are basically two ways to do that. One is through regulation and rules, which I think are one option. And the other is to recognize that the power of the internet is based on really three things. One is public policy that preserves and advocates for an open internet. And that means governments who care about freedom of expression online have to act on those beliefs. Two is the power of responsible companies to keep the internet open. When Google decides that it can no longer operate directly in China because of threats to free expression and makes that statement publicly and actually acts on that, that is a powerful statement to the world that maybe no other actor can provide because it is the preeminent search engine or it is the leading product in so many places. And three is understanding that the internet is evolving rapidly through technology and policy, and therefore new technologies that circumvent censorship or protect privacy are going to be essential. And given that those are the three key elements to maintain an open internet, working on something like the Global Network Initiative became a very important and viable option for us. And in 2006, and later, we were talking to the U.S. Congress and other lawmakers about putting rules in place to protect freedom of expression and privacy online. Simultaneous to that, a group of academics and companies like Google were discussing what kind of standards needed to be in place to protect freedom of expression and privacy online. And then about a year or so later, we got together with the companies, academics, and investors to try and develop those rules, which were ultimately launched in about October of 2008. And our hope was that if you have progressive companies and human rights organizations and socially responsible investors and some of the world's leading academics on the issue saying, here are the basic minimum standards that companies should comply with to protect freedom of expression online and privacy, and here is a system that will actually allow a third party to come in and assess whether they're doing that, then you, as the public, will have some reasonable degree of certainty that when a company says they're doing something to protect human rights, they're actually doing it. And that's going to be an important first step in pushing back on the governments and on the places in the world that are trying to close the internet, is first get the leading companies to sign on to principles of human rights and show that they're being implemented, and then work together with them, not only to develop those standards and to implement them, but to develop common positions on what freedom of expression and protection of privacy means online. So that was kind of the underlying philosophy of joining the Global Network Initiative, or starting the process that would lead to the Global Network Initiative. But it isn't without risk, because I think for Human Rights Watch, what we would see as the ideal protection of freedom of expression and privacy online is not necessarily what Google might see, for a variety of reasons. And it's not because one or the other is good or bad or better or worse, it's that they are different institutions. And it is not always easy for a human rights organization and a private company to get together and decide, one, that human rights are okay, and two, decide mechanisms to actually figure it out. But that was done. And now the challenge for all of us is to show that it's a credible process and that it works. My hope is that it will. But one of the major challenges for it is that it gets widespread acceptance and traction. So far, the Global Network Initiative has really been driven by groups in the U.S., both human rights organizations, companies, and the like, but has seen support from governments like the Dutch government. But what we really haven't seen are European companies, international companies, other governments really say that what is important today is that companies and other actors protect freedom of expression online. And it's going to be critically important, because wherever you are in the world, the ability to use the internet as a medium to hold institutions accountable is going to be critical. And I'll give you a basic example. We've done a lot of work on corruption in Angola. And what we documented at one point was that between 1997 and 2002, the Angolan government could not account for roughly $4.2 billion in oil revenue. In that same period of time, all social spending in the country was $4.2 billion, meaning that the amount of money that had been squandered or stolen by the government was roughly equal to everything they had spent on the population for health, education, welfare, housing, and the like. And it's no surprise then that every measurable standard of living and development indicator declined during that period of time. And this is now the largest oil producer in sub-Saharan Africa. The way that information got out when we publicized it wasn't necessarily by word of mouth, and it certainly wasn't by radio because the government censored it. It was by the internet. And today, in response to that type of work and that type of scrutiny, the government of Angola has had to conduct an audit of its state-owned oil company, where most of this money has disappeared. And where is that information published? On the internet, on the Ministry of Finance website. And Angola is a place where mobile broadband has really transformed the country, because between, say, 2000 and 2006, there was almost no internet access, and thus there was very little information outside the capital. But mobile broadband changed it, and now there's internet access throughout the country, and anyone can go to the Ministry of Finance website now and figure out what the state-owned oil company is doing with their money. So it's basic things like this that we're looking to see the internet protect, but the starting point for that is going to be things like the Global Network Initiative, is going to be government supporting freedom of expression online and creating an expectation among companies that they have to do that. And, you know, derived from that is an expectation from the public that when they get online, when they use a Google, or when they use something that Microsoft provides, or they use a blogging service from some other company, that there be basic protections for their human rights as well. And with that, I'll stop and open it up to questions about this issue as well.
Yeah, I have a question to Susan.
Okay.
Why do you think the European corporations in your field are so reluctant to join the GNI?
It's a really interesting one. I think initially, and it's one that we've thought about a lot. I think initially it was just the way it was set up historically was by a number of US companies, a number of US technology companies that were perhaps already seeing and experiencing some of the pressures to either restrict content or interestingly also for access to user information. And I think that's an interesting angle, that in the US, I think citizens are much, much more concerned than what I see in Europe in the sense of what their governments are doing and what access their governments have to information about them. I think in the European Union context, it tends to be much more focused on institutions and organisations, and I think that's quite an interesting one. So, and I think the GNI was addressing both elements, free expression, but also looking at the right conditions in which, or the right processes by which governments could seek access to information, and where companies could and should be pushing back on those requests. So I think there was to some extent a US perhaps specific element of the whole package that drove that initially. But I think as the use of technology, you know, becomes so commonplace, so widespread, as every type of company has some exposure to the internet, online, it's no longer just an issue that you can put in a particular part of the world or a particular group of companies. I think, to be perfectly honest, it's also a fairly new organisation. It's been, you know, as founders, we've had to work out how do we put this into practice, how do we get it up and running, how do we, what are the working conditions, if you like, by which the various members, all independent members in their own right, come together, express concerns in positive, constructive ways, and try to find common ways forward. And I think that's taken time, a little bit, to be fair as well. And it now has a staff, full-time staff, and we're really looking into, okay, we believe it's very, very valuable. Therefore, let's get more awareness on it, and let's get more people, companies, NGOs, individuals interested in what it's trying to deliver, which is a responsible approach to freedom of expression, openness, transparency, and user access requests.
Freedom of expression and transparency and openness is very, very important, of course, and GNI protects this. But equally important is privacy. And you mentioned a very impressive example with Angola. What about privacy?
Well, one way to look at it is I think that there are many governments in the world that are quite supportive of protecting freedom of expression online. European governments, the US and others, have a pretty strong background in that. And I would also say cynically that no government in the world will say no if you tell them, can we give you every bit of information on everyone in your country online if you would have it? And every government would say yes. So I think that the threats to privacy are much more widespread for legitimate as well as not so legitimate reasons. And therefore, it's incumbent on companies, on human rights organizations and others to really define the standards. And I'll give you an example. I mean, if you look at issues related to terrorism around the world, or if you look at what, say, the U.S. is doing in certain laws and things, one thing that's prevalent anywhere in the world is governments want access to information. And so it is going to be, in many ways, incumbent on non-governmental organizations, companies and the like, to define human rights standards for it. And hopefully GNI will, but it isn't an easy issue. I mean, there is a law enforcement reality to these issues that we are all grappling with, in that if people need to conduct legitimate criminal investigations, they need to have the data to be able to do it. So the question then is, what are the right processes? What is the right way of doing this so that you can both balance the need to protect rights with the need to legitimately investigate, versus what we see in some jurisdictions like China and elsewhere, which is trying to obtain information for purposes that would not be legitimate under human rights norms. And so that it's a real challenge. And I don't think we've actually solved the problem, but at least there's an effort to try and address the problem. It's also important to know that the challenge is coming from everywhere. It's not just countries you would think that censor. It's everywhere at this point.
Can I just jump in on that? I think also it's important to understand that there are different layers even to that question, different issues within that question. There's obviously the way in which companies protect the privacy of their own users and communicate those settings and options to their users. That's at a sort of B2C level. Mm-hmm. There's the government to company, and I don't call out any specific countries in this. This is common on a global level, the rights and the procedures in place for governments to seek information legitimately from companies and where the boundaries to that lie, not only domestically, but interestingly also cross-border. And there are mechanisms, things like the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, MLAT, but you know, there are many who would quite like to bypass that process. And we, you know, even in our world, we have to remind, remind government authorities that there is a process by which you go through. And that puts the onus on companies like Google and others also to really assess those requests and make sure, A, they're under, you know, the right jurisdiction, the right applicable laws. Are they overreaching? If they are, pushed back. And we, you know, it's publicly... you can read publicly about the times, you know, we've done that across a range of different issues to protect users from overreaching government requests. So that's the second layer, I would say. And then I think the third, perhaps, issue, and I'm sure there are many, many more, but these are the three top ones that spring to mind, is governments themselves can be quite, as was hinted at, you know, can be quite schizophrenic about, and legitimately so, in the sense that there are two sets of competing legitimate interests, national security and privacy. But what I do see is quite often those discussions take part, whether it's within an individual country or within regional organizations or global intergovernmental organizations, those discussions can tend to take place in two parallel tracks and never really meet and say, okay, we want user anonymity, but at the same time we want national security, and therefore we want to be able to verify who these individuals are. And you know, any of you in this room can see that there's a tension between those. But I think going forward, what I really hope that we'll see is much more open discussion across governments and in the broader community, along the lines of an open platform like GNI and others, about, well, how do you bring them together? And then how do you differentiate between perhaps governments that you trust to give information to, governments that you think may not be using information for legitimate purposes? And all of those things all come under, I think, that big bucket issue of privacy. So it's not as simple as it would appear.
Yeah, I mean, I can weigh in. I'll give you an example that affects everybody in this room. There's a growing debate about the right to anonymity, that is, your ability to go on a website and post a comment anonymously, you know, whether it may be for the hotel you stayed in or political commentary. And there are governments now in the world that want to eliminate that. I mean, Human Rights Watch actually believes that you do have the right to post anonymously, in the sense that it is a way to exercise freedom of expression, and the failure or the inability to have it has a chilling effect on commenting politically. But if you look at a place like China, there is an ongoing movement to require people to register in their real names, which is a way for the government to actually get information about you whenever it wants. And in fact, the world's largest domain registrar, GoDaddy, actually pulled out of China precisely for that reason, because they thought the security threat was too great, and more importantly, that the Chinese officials had not only asked them to register any future clients in this way, but all past clients as well. So something as basic as that has enormous human rights implications, and yet governments would love to have that because it's the easiest way to get information about people.
This is NPR Berlin, FM 104.1. You're listening to a discussion on human rights and the Internet at the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin. Google's public policy director, Susan Pointer, is discussing the Global Network Initiative, an international nonprofit dedicated to preventing Internet censorship. More after the break. This is NPR Berlin, FM 104.1.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear conversations that you won't hear anywhere else.
Do you understand love?
Well, I understand caring. See, most of my relationships are more intellect, and to me, love is caring.
Posing questions to fascinating people like Temple Grandin and giving them the time to answer on Fresh Air.
Weekday evenings at 6 on NPR Berlin 104.1.
Thank you.
This is NPR Berlin, FM 104.1. We're back with the first lecture in a series from the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin and the Human Rights Watch. This week's guests are discussing the relationship between human rights and online censorship. And now, questions from the audience.
So it's not easy to ask the first question, but I will try anyway. I'm Joachim Safelsberg from the University of Minnesota. And in what you talk about, there are intense conflicts between the freedom of expression, but then concerned with the protection from hate speech, for example. You talked about the tension between availability of information, and then there is, on the other side, concern with privacy, and Google Street Map is an issue in this context. You talked about the kind of rules that corporations themselves try to set up about how to balance these conflicts. The question is, and I'm not talking about authoritarian governments, but about the democratic process in democratic states and countries, what weight this democratic process ought to have in finding the appropriate balance between in these fields of tension, and if maybe there would, as a consequence, be nation-specific solutions in finding the appropriate balance. Thank you so much.
Who wants to answer that?
I think the last point you made was actually quite important. Even in the context of GNI or draft legislation that has been put together in Europe as well as the US, there's an enormous amount of deference to functioning legal systems. And even GNI principles say to a company that where you are presented with what seems to be an overbroad or request from a government that threatens human rights or is seen to threaten human rights, you have to take every measure to contest that through legal means. So I would say that as a general principle, there's an enormous amount of deference to using legal processes to try and solve the problem, but it is important for a company to actually use those processes. Where it becomes more challenging is where there is no rule of law, or more accurately, where the rule of law is really controlled by one party, where the government has more power to influence the decision than what would be true in an independent court, for example. And there you have to look to other means. Some of it can be corporate conduct. Some of it has to be external diplomatic pressure. And some of it has to be basic refusal to comply in certain situations. And I think that China is a good example of that, where the system isn't conducive towards actually contesting in a court in the same way you would in Germany or elsewhere. But I think that a lot of norms are going to be established through courts and through legal processes as well.
Should I jump in?
Yes, please.
So the question about the potential conflict between freedom of expression and, if you like, abuse of freedom of expression, hate speech and things. Absolutely. It's a communication channel. Just like the telephone or the postal service, it's a great communication channel. It's an additional communication channel. But human nature will use that communication channel for good or bad. And just as in the offline world, there have been rules established about where those boundaries lie. I think there's a misperception that the internet is some sort of wild west, that there are no rules on the internet. The rules that apply offline, whether it's privacy or copyright or defamation, apply equally online. And in fact, in many cases, there are additional layers of regulation and legislation in the online space that supplement and build on top of the existing rules. So there are actually a lot of rules. I think in general terms, it's much easier for countries, for governments, for operators within the rules. And obviously, we don't set the rules. That's done by governments. Much easier where there is global consensus. So I think you probably wouldn't find a government that wants to promote child pornography. You probably wouldn't find a government that would want to promote hate speech. However, if you ask for the definition of hate speech, it probably doesn't exist, or certainly not exist in a common way. I think So that's where it gets more complicated at one level, where there is no global consensus on what we mean by a particular type of content. And then an additional layer of complexity, even once you move beyond those largely consensual areas, if you move into national specific restrictions, that's where it becomes particularly challenging, particularly the internet space, where in theory, users can choose to access content wherever it may be coming from on the internet. And where you, and it's very challenging. For example, YouTube has been banned in Turkey for the past 2 years. And that's, even though YouTube has no presence in Turkey, doesn't direct activities towards Turkey, that's based on a court decision within Turkey that said videos on the US site that are critical of Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the modern Turkish state, should be removed on a global basis because they breach Turkish law, where there are restrictions on what you can say about Kemal Atatürk. So it's a really interesting one. Even without going into the detail, you've got really interesting jurisdictional issues there. And the reason YouTube remains banned is that YouTube has refused to remove those videos that are legal, legitimate, protected under free speech in the country in which they were uploaded, hosted, etc. But has refused to remove those on a global basis in order to have the ban from Turkey lifted. So that's where it gets really interesting, when you've got specific national, and I'm not commenting on the national law itself, that's for you know, Turkish citizens and their democratic process to look at. But if you seek to try to impose those national laws on the internet as a whole, then you can see that you're in potentially a very slippery slope as far as maintaining maximum access to information and free expression. So there are all those layers of complexity, and those are the layers of complexity that we live day in, day out.
Yeah, thanks. My name is Roman. I'm from Humboldt University. I have a comment and two questions. That's why I try to be real quick. First, the comment is, speaking about censorship, there's been a lot of issues about governments and stuff. I just want to add that there's also a great threat going out from private enterprises or foundations. For example, in Germany, the Bertelsmann Foundation has an enterprise called Arvato Services, which provides a service for corporations to track critic blogging posts or comments in the internet, and then like working against it, which means they post other comments lying about what the critics are and stuff. I think this is a great threat that also has to be kept in mind, speaking about censorship, which can be for profit of companies. Okay, now two questions. The first thing is, right now in Germany, there's a debate about scanning the content of my internet traffic, which is called deep package inspection. Probably most of the people here heard of it. And while Google, I mean, I use Google, it's a great service and stuff, but Google has a powerful crawling services. Now, is Google working on, let's say, providing services for deep package inspections? I hope not, but maybe you can say something about that. And the other thing is, in Russia, there's been a blog by nationalist racists which posted personal data from people who fight against racism. And so they posted photos of them, their address, and let's say they outed them and giving them free to be hunted. And since this was a Google blog, there was a campaign by Google users to ban this site and to delete it. But what happened was they deleted some pictures of people who were outed there, and the site still exists, and there are new pictures on it. Why can't this be deleted? I mean, are there Russian laws speaking against it, or because this is attacking freedom of speech to out people who are fighting against racism, for example? Thanks.
Okay, there are two questions. One is the packaging issue. The other one is the hate speech issue. I think they're both directed to you.
Okay, so in general terms, Google supports the free flow of communications between the user and the user they're intending to send their communications to. We've been involved, obviously, in discussions about traffic management, and which is largely where the ISPs are focused, and we've spoken about, whilst we think it may be legitimate for ISPs to manage traffic based on what types of service need to move quickly. So, for example, if you want your video packets to arrive in the right order at speed, if your email is a few seconds late, you're not too worried in that legitimate traffic management. Where it's a case of doing more than that, or prioritizing, or combining that with what you know about the user, then that's not our business.
Before you answer the second question, I just want to ask Arvind, do you agree?
Well, I think it underscores a point. I mean, like I said at the beginning, the three ways to deal with human rights on the Internet are understanding public policy, corporate responsibility, and technology. The reality of the Internet is that technology is evolving at an enormous pace. And to think that things like deep packet inspection or a variety of other technologies aren't going to be available to someone is probably unrealistic, and obviously it's unrealistic. So then the question is, what rules prescribe the use of those technologies? Right? When is it appropriate for an ISP or anyone else to use it? If it is for a legitimate and uncontroversial public purpose or commercial purpose, fine. If it is to track the individual activities of users for purposes that could inhibit political speech or lead to censorship or unduly invade someone's privacy, then no, it's not fine. But the only way you can solve that problem isn't by looking at the technology. It's by setting the rules around the use of that technology, either through government action or through GNI or something. And where I feel there's enormous deficits right now, although less so in Europe in some ways, is the fact that governments really haven't set out the rules to strike the right balance. And we're in a process now where people are trying to do that. I mean, as a practical matter, GNI wouldn't exist if governments had done that well. Right, I mean, that's the reality. So I think, I mean, it speaks a lot to the fact that this is an evolving area that needs urgent attention, but it's still evolving.
And the second question, I think, was related to specific content removal in Russia on a blog. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so without looking into the details, I wouldn't want to comment on the specific case because I don't have the details to hand right now. But I think that the key point there is, And it's something we face with requests for content removal in general terms, is there is no other way but looking at it on a case-by-case basis. So there are rules. I think, A, you've got to be transparent about on what basis you remove content. So I mentioned earlier, for example, the YouTube community guidelines. I carry them with me everywhere because people are always quite surprised to see that they can literally just read them. Just do a search online, you'll find them, they're there. And those are, in each case, you do have to look at it on a case-by-case basis, because what could be claimed as hate speech could turn out to be actually trying to remove something based on political expression. What could be difficult content, and let's face it, the right to free expression also protects a right to views that we may not ourselves agree with, up to limits that may or may not be set by governments and services themselves. So again, you need to look at that. Is it free expression that we don't necessarily like, but it is free expression and it's legitimate free expression, a difference of opinion? Or does it cross a line that has been set? And for example, I mentioned earlier, the hate speech one is an interesting one in that, because there are no hard and fast rules that I've seen, and I frequently join international organizations talking about these issues. And the question is, to what extent is someone expressing a view that you would rather not hear, but is part of legitimate free expression? And to what extent is it going beyond that, perhaps to hate speech or inciting violence? And the reality is, you can usually only make that judgment on a case-by-case basis, particularly for videos, for example. Sometimes the picture may be fine and the words may take something over a line, or vice versa. So I don't know the specifics of that case, so I don't want to comment on that, but that's just a comment on generally how difficult it is, and also how important it is to look at it in detail. Because, and this comes back to an earlier point of this potential justification creep, if you as a company received a list from an organization, an NGO, a government, anyone that says, we think this should be removed because it is hate speech, then it's incumbent upon organizations and companies like ourselves to look at that list and say, is it really, or is it embarrassing political comment that you would rather wasn't there? So it really, and it comes back to what we were saying earlier about the need also to push back where there are overreaching removal requests, because that's another area, and blacklists, there are examples of countries putting together blacklists that they would provide to companies to remove that content. And again, one of the fears in that is not necessarily the original purpose for those, which might be perfectly legitimate, again, things like protecting children. Or, but if those lists start becoming a convenient vehicle for having much broader content removed, then that's a danger to the openness of the internet and free expression.
I mean, one way to look at it, though, I mean, some thinking, say, behind GNI is, what should the user be aware of, and what processes should be available to the user when that happens? So say, I mean, say in large terms, that maybe taking down a whole website is a threat to free expression. However, in the specific case of publishing personal user information, then the question is, does that person whose information has just been published have a clear understanding that it's been published? Do they have a clear place to go with the company where they can say, I don't want my information online, I want the right to anonymity? Is there a process within that company to address that in an expeditious way and in a fair way? I mean, these are all the things that I think certainly people should look for. And this is part of the discussion about GNI and elsewhere, is what does a company put up? What does it tell its users it does or can do in the event something like this is happening? So I would actually distinguish the two in the case, if I'm somebody and somebody's just put all my personal information online, what redress is available to me, both legally and through that company? And I think that's an important issue, and it should be pushed on more, and people should be asked more about it.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to an NPR special from the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin and the Human Rights Watch. The guests this week were Susan Poynter, Public Policy Director at Google, and Arvid Ganesan, Director of Business and Human Rights from the Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C. They discussed the Global Network Initiative, an international nonprofit organization that defends freedom of speech and expression online. For program information, to read our blog, and for news updates, please visit nprberlin.de. And for more information about the lecture series, you can visit hertie-school.org or hrw.org. The recording engineers for this program were Silviu Mihai and Pavel Conrad of the Hertie School. Our production group includes Mitch Eaton, Kingsley Smith, and Sarah Richards. For NPR Berlin, I'm Neil Conan.